Health and Human Services Finances will come to order. Representative Albright moves approval of minutes from March 28, 2018. Do I have any corrections or additions? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 28th, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Minutes are approved. First up, today we have House File 3287, Representative Whalen.
With you.
Representative Whalen, I will move that House File 3287 be re-referred to the General Register. We have the bill before us. There are no amendments. There is an amendment, Representative Whalen, to the DE-5 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The DE-5 is mostly technical and came about after conversations with the Minnesota Department of Health and Lodging Association as they requested clarity on a couple things. It does not change the overall intent of the bill, which is to require that all hotel employees undergo training to recognize the signs of sex trafficking. The amendment does, again, provide clarity on a few things on who is specifically required to take the training on line 1.6, the effective date. It also says that the hotels may certify the training in a roster or in the employee file. We added a requirement that a poster be posted in the employee area on sex trafficking, and also on lines paragraph B we changed, so line 1.3 to 1.4. We had an exemption for resorts, but because the chapter already exempts them, because the chapter just applies to hotels and motels, that was not necessary, and so that was taken out because it was redundant. Happy to answer any questions on the amendment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for explaining the DE-5 amendment, Representative Whalen. Are there questions from members regarding the DE-5 amendment? Seeing no questions, all those in favor of adoption of the DE-5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The DE-5 amendment is adopted. Representative Whalen, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As this is the Finance Committee, I will try and be brief on my overview and then focus on the fiscal note, but I would like to share the idea for the bill came to me over the interim. I was asked to speak at an event that raises money for organizations that fight sex trafficking. And so I realized I was not an expert, dug into our laws, and found Minnesota is actually a leader in this area with our safe harbor laws, but it's still a large problem. And so I asked myself, what could we do to improve? I asked our research staff, indeed I owe a huge thanks to them, and some colleagues, Representatives Pinto and Baker, have been huge helps and advocates on this as well. And ended up with the bill that's before you today, which is based off of a Connecticut bill that requires this. In fact, Connecticut's the only state so far that is requiring this training. Just a little bit of background on sex trafficking. The Human Trafficking Task Force in Minnesota knows it is a public health, public safety, and human rights violation that occurs all around the world, but also in communities throughout Minnesota. International Justice Mission notes that 2 million children are exploited in the global commercial sex trade. Human trafficking as a whole generates about $150 billion per year, two-thirds of which is from commercial sexual exploitation. The Polaris Project found that in over 1,400 documented cases of human trafficking in hotels between 2007 and 2015, 92% of the cases involved sex trafficking. And as an article in your packet will highlight, this crime does occur often in hotels. And while the article notes a particularly horrific case, it also notes that the industry is facing increasing critiques that they may not be doing enough to combat this problem. I will say in Minnesota, we are doing quite a bit to combat sex trafficking as a general rule. Indeed, as I said, I think we're a leader. And many hotels are participating in this training voluntarily. But again, we could be doing more. And so what you have before you is a requirement, similar to the law in Connecticut, that all hotels train their employees to recognize these signs. Notably, the bill does have a zero cost to the state. If you look at page 4 of the fiscal note, it highlights that the Department of Health currently performs routine inspections of hotels and motels every 12 to 24 months, and adding this requirement should not increase the amount of time they spend at each hotel by much, so that they don't believe it will add cost. Furthermore, they find often that if a hotel is in violation of one requirement, they're often in violation of another. So they do not anticipate that this will cause any increase in their enforcement measures at the time spent on non-compliant hotels. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to answer questions. I also have a few folks here to testify and would be happy to have them up as well.
That sounds great. Representative Whalen, I see Mr. McElroy is here. Why don't we get the testifiers to come forward? Welcome to the committee, Mr. McElroy. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman and members, good morning. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Lodging Association. If I could ask a page, I apologize for a last-minute handout, but we had an opportunity to share with you what a poster would look like or does look like to alert our hotel employees about the risks of sex trafficking. The members of the Minnesota Lodging Association support this bill. We thank Representative Whalen for authoring it. You'll note it's a DE-5 because it's undergone some work since it was originally drafted, and it will work for our industry. My members are opposed to any crime in hotels. When people do bad things in our buildings, it's hard on our guests, it's hard on our employees, and it's a danger to our reputation. But they take this one extremely seriously. My members are moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas. And the female owner of a hotel in Roseville said it best when she said, "I do not want to rent rooms to a guest where little girls have been raped in our beds." And they take this seriously and have since about 2013. Ramsey County Attorney John Choi, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman, Washington County Attorney Pete Orpitz have been the most active. They came to us, I believe, in 2013, and we began a serious effort to provide training. Many of our members do this training. What we call branded or franchised hotels have a brand requirement to require the training. But this mandate will help us spread the training to a variety of other properties that may be independent, may not have access to the materials. So we're looking forward to working with the Department of Health and with the community of organizations that are concentrating often on helping victims, as you will hear. We want to help on the prevention side and keep it's 98 or 99% girls being the victims. There are some boys. We may change the language in this poster just a little bit to make it people instead of men, because there may be some women that are involved as well. But in general, this is a problem of little girls being the victims. And we're going to do everything we humanly possible to keep that out of Minnesota's hotels. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm happy to take questions if there are.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. McElroy. We have Lori Paul. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony, Ms. Paul.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Paul, and I'm an employee with Breaking Free. We are a survivor-led organization. Women that have been, adult women who have had effects of sexual abuse, trafficking in their life, and are trying to come out of the life or are out of the life. My story goes back about three decades, and I was an employee at a restaurant bar on 494 Strip in Bloomington, very popular. And there was a man that would come in, and he started to build a relationship with me. And, you know, started out flirting just like any type of relationship would be. I have since learned that that is called the lover boy strategy. And so as that relationship built, as he would give me gifts and different things like that, he met up with me then, and instead of going to my place or to his place, he took me to a hotel. And I thought, what? Right there on the strip. And I don't remember anything really before that, and I don't remember anything after that. But I remember the hotel. And I knew something was off. Why are we going to a hotel? And we went inside. And he was a big man. And I had already come this far in the relationship. So I wasn't bold enough, strong enough. I was a young girl. I didn't know to run. We didn't have the cell phones. We didn't have anything like that at that time. But yet when you're in that situation, you don't know what to do. And I remember walking in and having my head down, and he stopped by, and he got a room, and we were in that room maybe an hour, 2 hours. And then we came back out again, and I remember just thinking about the person at the desk, do you know what just happened to me? Could should have just looked up or said, hey, what's your name? Or, I mean, obviously it wasn't okay. And I was never so happy when that hotel got torn down. But I carried that for a long time. And I found out and I figured out what was happening and what that true intent was. And I tried to live a normal life after that. But there's a lot of residual things that happen. And it isn't always the same places and faces that you would maybe expect. But no, when a woman isn't obviously happy to be there or comfortable or something, the people need to be aware. And so this brings that out. Because there's a lot of us that's our first place of contact where trafficking begins. So thank you for listening. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Yeah. Paul. We appreciate that. Mm-hmm. I understand you have other testifiers who may be here to answer questions about the bill, some folks from law enforcement, and Mr. McElroy is here from the industry. Is there anyone else from the audience who would like to testify on behalf of this bill? All right, seeing none, we'll close down the testimony portion and go to member questions. Members, Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not so much a question, but just a comment. So as folks know, I was for a couple of years the director of statewide training and protocol development for the Safe Harbor System, and the poster that you have in your hands, I actually wrote the text of this under guest rooms and hotel areas, et cetera. We partnered with the Minnesota Lodging Association. I produced the first hotel training that we did in 2012 together, and it featured in the hotel video, in fact, the training video from that time. And so I appreciate the work. It really does make a difference. I've done trainings all over the state, including in hotels, and can think of cases that really prompted that, where in the one instance, there's a 911 call that I play all the time at trainings that occurred at a hotel where the incident did. And in that case, the hotel staff thought that something was wrong, but just didn't have it in them, didn't feel comfortable enough to reach out to do something. They could tell something was off. Fortunately, in that case, the victim survivor did call 911. And another case where the hotel staff did have their eyes open, and if they had not reached out to police, then the trafficking situation would have continued. So I'm grateful to Representative Whalen, and we mentioned before that we partnered on this. Apologies that I wasn't here at that time, but I appreciate getting to work with you on this. And I guess I'll do the question for Mr. McElroy. So when I did the first version of this poster, it took a lot of work to translate it into Somali, Hmong, and Spanish as well, which we did. And I'm just curious if you have a version of this poster in those other languages as well at this point.
Mr. McElroy.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, not yet. That's the plan. We'll start with Spanish, and then we'll work on the others. But right now, we're distributing it in English. The bill calls for us to work with the Department of Health and arranging for translation will be part of what we plan to work on.
And Mr. Chair, I'll note that, Mr. McElroy, so almost all the text is in those other languages in the earlier version of the poster, and so happy to connect, and we may be able to save the state some resources and effort for that translation into those other languages.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto. That'd be very helpful.
Okay, and thank you again, Representative Whalen, for bringing this forward. It's really important to do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Whalen, for this really important legislation. It's an important conversation, and thank you for sharing your personal story. I couldn't say how sorry I am. I also think that the fact that we're here having this conversation says a lot about how far we've come in talking about sex trafficking and who the victims are in this situation. I completely agree that this is a situation where victims are helpless to speak out in so many ways, and we need a whole community around us to make sure that this isn't happening in our neighborhoods, in our communities, in our hotels. And also, I can't say enough how grateful I am to hear from the Lodging Association, Mr. McElroy, from law enforcement, that we are going to team up in this effort and protect people. It wasn't that long ago we weren't treating victims like victims in the same way. And so I think that we've come a long way. My question that I have, and I'm not sure who could answer this, is I'm so pleased to see call 911, no concern is too small. is there training going on the dispatcher side as well, in tandem with this effort, so that, to Representative Pinto's point, if somebody calls and said something just feels off, what kind of response will they get?
Representative Whalen.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If it's okay, I'd like to have one of our testifiers come up.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Eric Fadden. I'm a sergeant with Plymouth Police Department. I currently supervise our special investigation unit, which is tasked in part combating human trafficking. And I've been in this position for 3 years or so, and since that time we, like so many others, have shifted our focus to concentrate on treating victims like victims. And it started kind of with our department in the western suburbs, and partnering with Minneapolis Police Department and a number of other agencies throughout the metro in preparation for the Super Bowl. We spent a lot of time raising awareness, not only throughout the metro, but throughout the state, on just what our efforts were and what we found was really working, and just focusing on at least raising more awareness in the law enforcement community, including dispatching and, you know, other agencies in this fight to deal with just kind of educating the safe harbor law and just what our efforts were. So to your question, yes, we are being we are raising awareness. It started kind of informally a few years ago, and now it's just becoming more prevalent throughout our training.
Thank you, Sergeant Fenton. Representative Pinto, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I did, and I guess it's two now, just to follow up and to respond to Representative Henderson's question as well. So there were a few years ago, there was an effort in a couple communities at a statewide conference of 911 operators. I've done some training to those, but I do think we probably could use something more comprehensive similar to this for that population, because that concern has been presented a lot with the posters. They want to make sure the handoff is to somebody who's set up. I will say that the handoff beyond 911 to local law enforcement, there's been a lot more going on, and looking at the sergeant now, to make sure that next handoff when the officers arrive is in good shape. And the other follow-up, Mr. Chair, is just there's a piece of paper in the packet that relates to information about trafficking cases in Hennepin and Ramsey counties that makes a reference to the race and ethnicity of defendants. And it was concerning enough to me just to make sure to point out to folks that it describes the overwhelming majority of cases involving defendants of one particular race and ethnicity, and I want to make sure it's clear to everybody and my colleagues and everybody else that traffickers come from every background, that people who are purchasing sex and purchasing sex trafficking victims come from every background as well, and that there's no particular concentration in any one race or ethnic group. And I think it's important enough, since it's in members' packets, that they recognize that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Representative Pinto, for your comments and for all of your support. As mentioned, working with you has been incredibly, incredibly helpful. The handout that was included, thank you for pointing that out. I just included that to note what is being reported to the hospitality industry. But that was a really good clarification, so thank you, Representative Pinto.
Representative Johnson.
Representative Willard, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. This isn't just an issue in Minneapolis, St. Paul, Duluth, St. Cloud. It covers every corner of this state, even in the small towns. This is an issue that we need to deal with, and I want to thank you for bringing this forward, because it's a very serious issue.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Further member questions for Representative Whalen or the testifiers? All right. Representative Whalen, would you like to conclude?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. In closing, I'll just say this bill has truly been a collaborative effort. It was amazing to me just how the law enforcement community, the hospitality industry, advocacy groups, and our own members came together in support to combat this horrific issue. And as was mentioned, you know, with the Super Bowl being here, we see often a slight increase in sex trafficking, but it's really important to remember it occurs all around us, all the time. But because of the Super Bowl being here, there has been momentum, and it just feels like an opportune time to take a next step forward So with that, I'll just say thank you and appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative Whalen. Thank you, Representative Pinto, for working on this bill. And I know Representative Whalen works really hard on the bill, so I feel really good about sending this on to Ways and Means, or the General Register, even better. No money. I'll renew my motion that House File 3287, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 3287, as amended, is on its way. Thank you, Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Next up, we have Representative Munson. Welcome to committee, Representative Munson. I will move House File 3825 be re-referred to the General Register. The bill is before us. Representative Munson, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and fellow members. This bill will change the renewal date for several allied health professionals, which currently is about 30,000 renewals that come in due mostly on the same day of the year. This department that manages the renewals is staffed by, you know, 7 or 8 employees. So in order to prevent a backlog of renewals happening at mostly the same day in the year, this just simply shifts that burden to be in the month of the practitioner's birth. So in much the same way that physicians renew their licenses in Minnesota, we're moving most of these professions to have their renewal dates spread out around the year.
All right. Thank you, Representative Munson. And Ms. Martinez is here to testify. And this is 3825. The bill is 23 pages long, and that's all it does, huh, Representative Munson?
That's right.
All right.
Wow.
Moves the needle in the right direction. Small.
Ms. Martinez, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I want to thank Representative Munson for carrying this bill and also Representative Albright as an author. This bill, as mentioned, does convert 6 of the board's allied professions, and it's thick because it's really a repetition of that conversion cycle across each of those 6 professions. It also does move some fees, existing fees, from rule to statute and codifies them in the individual practice acts. No new fees. I would like to emphasize that. Just reestablishing them in statute where they're a little easier to find and track. And also finally gives the board the authority it overlooked last year in adding genetic counselors to our allied professions. So that is it in a nutshell. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Ms. Martinez. Are there questions for the bill author of the testifier, Representative Lunan?
To the testifier, thank you, Mr. Chairman. When you were having all of the renewals at one time and you said that you had a staff of 7?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Martinez.
Representative Lunan, we actually have a staff of 6.
Okay.
And, it happens to be June 30th was the standard renewal cycle for all of these professions for many years. It's when we have our peak application processing time, when everyone applies for residency permits, they're completing schooling and applying for initial licenses. So having all of these renewals concurring at the same time as our peak processing period was challenging. We are happy to spread that across the calendar year just to give a little bit more efficient service to our application processing.
Representative Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question I have is that now being spread out across the year, and 6 were doing it at one point in the year before, is there a reduction in FTEs or a reduction in overtime? Or what? I mean, there should be, I'm assuming there's some intrinsic efficiency with this, and we realize that.
Ms. Martinez.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative Lunan. The online renewal process at this point in time has more than 90% of our licensees renewing online, so we don't see that this impacts staffing significantly. It really just makes staff more available to answer questions for those who are having some struggles in the application renewal process.
Representative Lunan.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this won't affect your staffing level at all, then?
Ms. Martinez.
Mr. Chair. Representative Lunan, it will not.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, is this Mr. Munson's first time in front of us?
I believe Representative Munson was to the Reform Committee and Chair Schumacher's committee. I don't know that he has been here before.
Oh.
All in favor?
No.
Mr. Chair.
With that lack of...
If
Representative Constantine was looking for treats, it should be noted that in the other committee he brought fruits.
So he failed miserably there, too. Is it?
Okay.
Because mentorship there on your side?
Yeah. Well, I would prefer that he brought nothing than bananas, so.
Goodness gracious, Mr. Chair.
You know, it's, yeah.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Considine, I did post on Twitter moments ago the my fruit bowl has become moldy, so I could have got the strawberries that have turned moldy to the pass those around for you.
Representative Munson, aren't you pushing cupcakes in larger amounts from home bakers?
Representative Considine, as you may know, Representative Munson was elected in a special election. He missed the entirety of the orientation, and I think consideration should be made on his behalf. Representative Munson.
Final words, is that what you...
as long as you like.
Mr. Chairman, members, in all my many... many weeks of being representative, I've never carried such an important bill as this, so I look forward to its passage.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you.
With that, Representative Munson, I will renew my motion that House File 3825 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no.
Aye.
Motion prevails. House File 3825 is on its way to the General Register. Thank you, Representative Munson. Next up, we have Representative Tice. House File 3451. I will move House File 3451 to the General Register. Representative Tice, House File 3451 is before us. There are no amendments to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I don't know that I got a special consideration when I came in on my special, but I'm going to keep that under my hat. Folks, this bill creates an exception to allow for the transfer of 66 residents from Whittier Place in Minneapolis to three locations in Hennepin County. And with that, I'm just going to turn it over to my testifier, Ryan Devney.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Ryan Devney. I work for Supportive Living Solutions. I'm here to discuss our bill that would allow us to move beds from Whittier Place's location in southeast Minneapolis to up to three other apartment buildings. Supportive Living Solutions provides housing to services to people with housing and services to people with severe and persistent mental illness. Most of our locations are apartment style settings where the client has their own lease and own an apartment or share a two bedroom apartment. However, one of our locations, Whittier Place, is based off of an older board and lodge style where there is two or three individuals may share a room and there's congregate dining space. What we wanted to do is give the option to our Whittier residents to be able to move from their current location into a setting where they would either have their own apartment or share a two-bedroom apartment. And this would allow them greater independence, more privacy, and allow for better person-centered care. Of course, the residents would have the option to be able to move. They would not be forced to do so. We have been in discussion with DHS in regards to this issue, and though they could not approve it themselves because of their own waiver language, they informed us that we would have to come to the legislation here to gain approval in this way. DHS did provide technical support with the language of this bill, and they do not oppose what we are trying to do. We also want to point out that there would not be a fiscal note to this, should not be a fiscal note to this move, as we are not looking to increase the number of people that are being served. We're simply trying to provide a better, more independent housing option for them. If there's any questions, Mr. Chair, committee members?
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think moving from
living with 66 people who have the same diagnosis and sharing bedrooms to your own apartment is definitely a step up. But under our Olmsted plan, we are committed to the federal government to move people to more independent living where they live independently in an apartment building they choose of their own in an integrated setting. And are you providing those sort of support services, or will your people have the option if they choose they want to stay in Southeast Minneapolis, for example, to just move into an existing apartment building that you don't own and still continue to receive support services from your organization?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, they are, you know, we led the Coalition for Choice, and we do believe it's all about choice of where individuals choose. We're just trying to provide another option for them that they might not otherwise be. The options that are available for our clients is minimal right now just because of the housing market and the way that it is. So if they were to choose to move into an option other than ours, that would be certainly fine, and there wouldn't be any issue with that. We encourage that as it is right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I just think it's important that when people settle into a community, they build friendships, they build connections, and even if the physical plant might be better somewhere else, it's starting all over again. And so the more that we can help people continue on with the kind of life and the community that they've settled into, I think that's good. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Is there anyone from the public who'd like to testify on this bill? Seeing none. Further member questions on the bill? Okay. Seeing none, Representative Tice, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your support.
Thank you, Representative. I will renew my motion that House File 3451 be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. House File 3451 is re-referred to the General Register. Next up, we have House File 3265, Representative Kreisha. As he's making his way down to the testifier's table, I will move that House File 3265 be re-referred to the General Register. And Representative Kreisha, I see that you do have an amendment, A2, Representative Kreisha, to the amendment.
I do, and thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And so I'll be really brief, but this bill was awesome, and then it got awesomer by the amendment we're going to add, which is Representative Bennett. So if you could move that amendment, and I'll let her speak to it.
I'll move the A2 amendment. Representative Bennett, welcome to the committee. I didn't know we were going to get you today, too, so that's even better. To the A2 amendment.
Mr. Chair, you got two for one. Actually, Mr. Chair, I almost dropped my dog list because I know he's partial to you, and then we would have had three, but I passed on that. I just like to say a little something about this amendment. It's actually a bill turned into an amendment here. And what this does is help children who are among the most vulnerable in our society, our foster kids. We know how important our siblings are to each one of us, and for foster kids are no different. As a matter of fact, what they're going through, I think siblings are probably even more important to foster kids. Children in foster care already face difficulties that are very tough to imagine, and I think we can help ease these hardships through promoting healthy growth by helping these kids stay connected to their siblings as much as possible. So this amendment builds upon the wonderful work our foster parents are already doing. It creates close connections for foster siblings when it's in the best interest of each sibling, including visits, phone calls, and taking part in important celebrations like birthdays. When we were in HHS, or the other HHS committee, we had a couple testifiers, which I think some of you heard, and they had some real compelling testimony on how important their siblings were to them, and they were unfortunately separated from them due to space and other issues, time and space and so on. So this would really help with that by creating some general expectations that we should keep those siblings together when possible and help them communicate and be part of birthdays and everything else.
All right. Thank you for explaining the A2 amendment. Are there questions from members on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Kreisha to 3265 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I have a testifier with me, Ms. Dina Johnson, and she's going to speak briefly to it. But what this bill does, in addition to what Representative Bennett's amendment is that we simply add the fetal alcohol syndrome certification to the 12 hours of training that we have a year. And the reason for that is because we know how important it is to understand why when a troubled child comes into a foster home, and this is helping those foster care parents understand what some of the difficulties and trauma those children may have when they come in. So with that, I'd like my testifier to give her presentation.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Dina Johnson. I'm a foster parent. I'm a fairly new foster parent. I received my license in December 2016 and took my training very seriously. The year prior to receiving my license, I watched every webinar, attended every seminar, read every book I could on teenagers and teenagers' trauma as I was planning to adopt from the foster care program a teenager. And so I took my training very seriously, and there was an orientation where there was a presentation on FASD that was eye-opening, to say the least, and scary for myself, scary for the others that were in the orientation, and some of them didn't come back after this presentation. So at that point, I realized that I needed more training than the state requirement before I received my license. And so by the time of my first placement, I had a few more hours in place. My first placement, was a teenage mom and her son. She didn't want to be adopted and was placed with me in long-term foster care. She enrolled at the Centennial Area Learning Center for at-risk teens, and she thrived here. She thrived here with well-trained teachers who understood her. They understood her emotional, her behavioral, her educational needs, and how to help her cope every day. She loved going to school. This was incredible testimony to the school for a child who hadn't been to school hardly at all the previous 2 years and not consistently throughout her childhood. But this is where she wanted to be, at school, because they got her. The placement lasted just over a year, but I was not able to help her thrive outside of the Learning Center. I wasn't able to help her. I didn't understand her, and I was just not equipped. I didn't get it, right? Should have been better trained. And so the placement disrupted, and she moved in with her sister just about a month ago. So I certainly believe that, like the well-trained teachers at the Learning Center, the foster parents could be more successful with ongoing training. And ongoing training is important. You get that training in the beginning, but you just don't connect the dots. It's not practical. You don't have any practical experience with it. So when you've got the kids in your house and you're doing this training, the dots connect. It just makes a lot more sense. Given my own experience, I also believe this would help to retain good foster parents. Good foster parents are going to embrace this hour of training and the opportunity to better understand their kids. Self-knowledge, best intentions, just not enough with these kiddos. I still plan to adopt a teen from the system, but I need more training. And I need my brain to just be thinking all the time about new strategies to help my kiddos, my kids' specific needs. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there further testifiers, or does anyone from the audience want to testify on behalf of this bill? Seeing none. Member questions. First up, Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I worked as a jail counselor for 21 plus years, and the last five realized that I had a significant number of clients with fetal alcohol syndrome. So I'm actually kind of interested in what training this is, because there's no test. There's no blood work you can do. What can you tell me a little bit about the training? I guess I would be real interested in knowing what training there is that you can get for working with people with fetal alcohol syndrome.
Representative Frieschel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Constantine. I don't specifically have the training from you. I haven't been through it. Last year, this is a continuation of last year's bill where we invoked this in the first year of their foster care certification, so now we're extending that out. But I can get you that information, and I can find out the people that do the training. But what I have heard is it's been immensely popular, which is why we're extending this out.
Your turn.
Thank you. Yeah, I would really appreciate it. I'd love to see it. I talked last night with a woman that works with people with fetal alcohol syndrome, and yeah, that's really a frustrating situation to deal with. They so often have the best of intentions and then do something that's just totally incompatible with what they're telling you, and you don't understand it, and yet when you realize that, fetal alcohol syndrome explains the behavior. So, thank you.
Representative Liebling.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, Ms. Johnson, first of all, just thank you for being a foster parent. That's a pretty big commitment, and boy, we need foster parents in the state, so thank you very much for that and for your obvious commitment to helping your kids that come under your care. I mean, that's so important. They're all our kids, and we need to make sure we do the absolute best. And it's not so much a question, but I just wanted to note that we heard testimony last night in this committee. We were here pretty late, and we were hearing testimony on a very different kind of a bill, but we did hear testimony from someone from MOFAS, if I think I got that right, the organization that works on fetal alcohol syndrome, and talking about just how prevalent this is, and that there are a lot of people, a lot of adults that are walking around with fetal alcohol syndrome, and it's kind of something that is often undiagnosed and unrecognized, and yet it's really impacting a lot of the way people process and a lot of their behavior. And so I'm so glad that we're giving this a little bit of the focus that it needs, and I hope that this will help some of those children do better than they otherwise would. So thank you for your efforts.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Liebling. I'd just like to respond to that because, Representative Liebling, you touched on something that's very important to this bill, and that is we do have a foster care shortage. And we know that parents, in the goodness of their heart, or people like Ms. Johnson, are stepping forward and asking to do this. Although the problem is, and we talk about the regulations, we talk about some of the hardships of getting into it, but the reality is one of the big obstacles that we face is when we get foster care parents like Ms. Johnson who realize the children that they're faced with are coming with a lot of baggage and they're coming with really difficult trauma. And so often, foster care parents, when they reach that point and realize how difficult it is, they just shut the door and they don't know if they can take that on. So when we get someone like Ms. Johnson who comes and says, not only do I want to keep doing this, but I want to figure out how I can get better at it, that's absolutely the kind of things that we should embrace. And that's why a bill like this becomes so important, because if we could find out how to make these foster care parents successful, we could probably increase our numbers rather than give them the obstacle and the easy way out, which is to say, this is too much for me to handle right now.
Thank you, Representative Prisha. I have a constituent that I'm working with right now who's a foster parent in the process of adopting sisters, both with very serious medical conditions and costs with fetal alcohol syndrome and other issues. And one of the things that that I've found is that the transfer in adoption comes with it a very, very large financial risk and of that ongoing medical costs and how we're doing that. Are we addressing that, do you think, enough, or do you think we need to think about or look at additional legislation that helps prospective parents, adoptive parents, with that process?
Yes to all that. You're absolutely right. I mean, as I dig into this further, we take really good people who want to do the right thing, and they're taking on some of the most troubled children, and then we often put all the more risk on top of them, sometimes with financial burdens, sometimes with insurance risk. And so I've tried to address those in some other ones. But, yeah, absolutely, I think we need to go further and further with this to help, because this is not like having a child and everything goes really, really well. This is taking on somebody that's had a past and then some parents that have been through some trauma and then adding all that together, and they don't just come to you and smile and coo and gaggle. They come to you and say, help me. And then when you throw on all the other hardships, yeah, that becomes very difficult. So, yes, we're not addressing enough to your question.
Thank you, Representative, and thanks for your work on the bill. I wonder if Mr. Byrd could just talk a little bit about the fiscal costs. We got the amendment and the underlying bill of where we're at with fiscal note and What's up with that?
Mr. Chairman, members, there's not a formal fiscal note on this. The department had testified in the Reform Committee that they were okay with the underlying bill, and I've subsequently talked to the department, and they remain fine with the underlying bill, and the amendment is no cost.
All right, and I guess we're fine to go to the GR, so any final words, Representative Precia?
No, thank you, members. I'd love to go to the GR and pass this before those who shall not be named.
All right. With that, Representative Precia, I will renew my motion that House File 3265, as amended, be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. House File 3265, as amended, is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you to Ms. Johnson and Representative Bennett. House File 3643, Representative Baker. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're going to lay over House File 3643. We're going to bring it up before the committee, and I understand there's a DE1 amendment.
That is correct, Mr. Chair, members. In front of you is a DE1 amendment that sort of expands a couple of things. It doesn't expand it. We'll talk about the pharmaceutical opportunity that we have to allow them to do some injectionable medicine on an ongoing basis, and we've got some testifiers to speak to that as well, Mr. Chair.
And that's there's also in the DE1 appropriation prescription drug deactivations. Is that right?
Is that the same?
Okay.
It's on the last page.
All right, members have that in their packet. All those in favor of adoption of the DE1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. The DE1 amendment is adopted. House File 3643 as amended. Representative Baker, would you like to go to testifiers?
A brief opening statement, Mr. Chair. As many members know, I'm working very hard this year to make sure we can do some real serious work on opioids and the damage it's caused to our communities. We are working on different versions and to collect these along the way. This version, this sort of the what I want to call maybe some cafeteria opportunities this year, to look at a lot of good bills that can do some good things because I've had enough of this. We've got to do more with opioids, but we're not doing enough because some of the people that need to be at the table aren't at the table, i.e. the drug manufacturers, and we're going to continue to work on trying to get them to step up during this session with some other ideas that are coming later. My ask today, members, is just to allow us to talk about some in-home disposable ways to get rid of the pills, the pharmaceutical heroin, that's currently sitting in most of your cabinets at home. We need to make sure that we address this the way it is. We also need to make sure that we find better, useful ways to use all of our medical professionals, i.e. pharmacists in this case today, to allow them to use some of the new cutting-edge medicine that's really doing some great things to keep people in recovery longer with some injectable medicine. So with that, Mr. Chair, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with the testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Root. I'm a pharmacist who practices primarily in the hospital setting in the Twin Cities. I am speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Pharmacy Advocacy Task Force, which is a collaborative of pharmacy organizations across the state of Minnesota from a variety of different practice settings, including the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. I'm asking for your support of the amended language on this bill, as I think it will help to reduce access to unused medications, particularly opioids, as Representative Baker mentioned, and also expand medication administration by pharmacists. This will improve access and quality of health care for Minnesotans. On the medication administration side, one example of improved care is within the mental health community. I have seen firsthand the challenges related to maintaining compliance with medication therapy in these patients. These patients end up in the emergency room, and it's challenging for them to find a facility that will provide ongoing care. For some patients, They're able to improve and maintain their mental health through use of long-acting injectable antipsychotic medications. However, there is a lack of access to care in underserved areas, as we all know, particularly in rural Minnesota, where I'm originally from. Pharmacists are one of the most accessible healthcare professionals and can support closing this gap. Pharmacists graduate with a Doctor of Pharmacy degree, and many go on to receive specialized residency training, so really totaling a decade of training that they're spending to become medication experts. And they're really working alongside physicians and nurses as part of a healthcare team. Medication administration is also included as part of this pharmacist training. While pharmacists are currently allowed by statute to administer immunizations, we're not currently allowed to administer other classes of medications beyond first dose and emergency doses. Pharmacists can help fill the void in underserved areas by expanding the type of medications we can administer, such as those long-acting antipsychotics, and as Representative Baker mentioned, other anti-addiction medications, to just name a few. This would allow us to serve a greater number of Minnesotans. And lastly, for those that may be a little bit competitive in nature, our neighbors to the east, west, and south already allow pharmacists to provide a broad range of medications to better serve their residents. This change would also allow us to better serve ours. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Rob Reynolds. I am the Director of Advocacy with Verde Environmental Technologies. Prior to that, I actually spent 31 years in Eden Prairie Police Department, serving the last nine as the chief. I'm here today to support this bill because I believe that prevention, specifically limiting access to unused pharmaceuticals, is key in our fight against the opioid epidemic. This bill would provide funding so that organizations could offer at-home options to the communities that they serve. As a police chief, I chose the at-home option because I always believed that the simplest path was the best. And the shorter I could make that chain between the person that wanted to get rid of unused pharmaceuticals and its ultimate destruction, the better the process would be, because every link in that chain added to the cost of the process, and it also added another opportunity for diversion. I chose at home because I believe that for my residents, it was the most convenient and an efficient way to get rid of their unused pharmaceuticals. They could do it immediately. As soon as they didn't need that medication anymore, they could get rid of it. They could get rid of it in the privacy of their own home. They didn't have to make any special trips or schedule something to get to a once-a-year take-back day or get to a particular location. As an organization, I favored at-home disposal because it allowed me an opportunity to provide my residents with a way of getting rid of these unused pharmaceuticals, but I didn't have to take on the burden and responsibility of collection, of storage, and ultimately disposing of these medications. So to me, it was clear that preventing access to or limiting access to these unused pharmaceuticals was a valuable undertaking, because we know that the statistics will show that 70% of the unused pharmaceuticals are sitting in our medicine cabinets waiting to be diverted or abused. We know that 80% of those people that are abusing opioids or heroin got them from the medicine cabinets of their friends and families. And to me, the most efficient and method of getting rid of these things was to use an at-home take-back method. That's why I chose it for the community that I serve. That's why in my retirement I chose to work for an organization that manufactures these, and I work with government and nonprofit organizations to try to get these at-home methods into their communities, and that's why I support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mr. Reynolds. There are two people. Mr. Weiberg would like to testify on this bill. So if I could call Cody Weiberg down. And Kirk Kadelka. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Weiberg. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Actually,
Mr. Kadelka, welcome.
Thank you, Chair and committee members and author. For the record, my name is Kirk Kadelka. I'm an assistant commissioner with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
And first off, I'd like to thank the author of the bill for the amendment. We had a discussion, and we're interested in continuing working with him on this. We share the same goals of making sure that our pharmaceuticals, the prescription drugs in our cabinets, are taken care of so that they can't be abused, as was talked about earlier, but also make sure when they are disposed of, it's done in a way that protects our water, because we are seeing these chemicals showing up in our sampling across the state. And so what we want to talk a little bit today about is the grant. As the legislature looks at a grant for this program, is to expand it to other uses, cost-effective, other proven methods that communities can use. And the two I'd like to just really quick highlight are drop-off boxes at law enforcement and pharmacies, along with mailback pouch envelopes that go through the U.S. mail. These allow for these drugs to be handled in a cost-effective manner. Law enforcement and pharmacy collection is anywhere from $2 to $9 per pound, and mailback $10 to $12 per pound, where some of the other options out there are much more expensive. This allows a cost-effective way to ensure that these prescription drugs go to an incineration, which is a preferred method to make sure that we don't have environmental issues later on. Because these both meet are cost-effective and meet our shared goals, we'd like to just ask the committee to look at opening up the grant to include other options that communities select. We know, for instance, right now there are 5 counties within Minnesota that do not have a drop-off location, and we are working to get funds for them. Communities that would choose different options that best fit their needs. 2 years ago, this committee and the legislature passed a law that allowed for these drop-off boxes, and we thank you. And since then, pharmacies have responded. Within the last 2 years, 130 new sites have popped up as a result of that change by the Board of Pharmacy and the legislature, and we appreciate that.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kadalka. Mr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. And I talked to Representative Baker a little bit. I'm in an odd position normally when I'm up here with him. I'm completely supportive of what he's doing. And I do support part of the bill that I'll talk to, but I do share, the board shares some of the issues that MPCA has. So just very brief history. Pollution Control Agency and the Board of Pharmacy have been actually working together for 10 years on pharmaceutical waste issues involving the public, even longer for pharmaceutical waste in pharmacies and hospitals. When I became aware in 2008-2009 that the first Sheriff's Department, Chisago County, was doing permanent collection, I just noted that they actually didn't have a legal authority to do that. So the board and the Pollution Control Agency worked to get the legislature to pass legislation in 2010 allowing law enforcement and counties to do these drop boxes. Then when the Drug Enforcement Administration passed federal regulations to allow pharmacies to do so, we came back a couple years ago to allow pharmacies to do so. To date, there are, if Mr. Kadalka didn't mention it, 350 permanent drop boxes around the state. The DEA regulations also allow for mailers, which people can also do from the convenience of their home. The DEA doesn't evaluate in-home destruction products. They have, however, endorsed the United States Postal Service mailback program that they have, and the U.S. Postal Service has put out a detailed presentation about how they believe this is a very safe way. Now, I have a little bit more perspective into this because my first job out of pharmacy school was actually as a poison information specialist, and we use activated charcoal all the time to treat poisonings. What happens with activated charcoal is not a chemical process. The molecule is not destroyed. It is adsorbed, not with a D, adsorbed, not absorbed. That means basically the activated charcoal is treated in a way that greatly increases its surface area and the drug molecules just stick on the surface. That's a reversible process. So what my colleagues at MPCA tell me is there is concern that if products like this are put into the landfill, ultimately the drugs will come back off and leach into the water supply. And so that's why we've been actually working on other alternatives. So that's really my only testimony. The board is not going to oppose this at all, but we do agree with MPCA that it might be best to broaden out the options so that the grants could be used for other purposes. Now, the other part of the amendment is administration of drugs by pharmacists. And I basically would say that the pharmacy associations actually came to me about this about 4 years ago. In my first, they came actually right at the beginning of a very busy session, and I said, not this year. And by the way, there could be a lot of groups that oppose you, but the first hurdle you have to get by is me, because you really need to convince me that pharmacists are going to be able to safely do these drugs. And I've thought about it quite a bit since then, and our law has changed since then. So we rewrote our disciplinary section, so it's now on professional conduct for pharmacists to do anything that is not consistent with professional standards. So I've already told the associations that the board will support this change, but I've reminded them that if it does pass, when we put out our annual newsletter about the laws that affect pharmacists, we will remind them that we'll expect them to follow the standard of practice, and part of the standard of practice is going to be to adequately train to administer any drug that they're going to administer. I do think that this has a real key role in the opioid issue because of the drug Vivitrol, which is a long-acting injectable product. There are pharmacies out there right now that work in conjunction with mental health clinics where the pharmacists could be doing these monthly Vivitrol injections that help keep people off of opioids. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Is there further testifiers on this bill? Anybody from the audience want to testify on the bill? All right, we'll close off the testimony portion, go to member questions. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm glad Mr. Weiberg is still at the table. As I read the amendment, and, you know, Representative Baker, thanks for bringing in the bill, and the amendment changes the bill. So as I read the amendment, it appears to me that pharmacists would be able to administer any medication. Is that the way you read this as well?
Dr. Weiberg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, yes, that is how this reads.
And Mr. Chair, and so I suppose for Representative Schumacher or Representative Baker, is this the first that we've heard this proposal? Because that is a significant shift in scope for pharmacists. And so I am, you know, just wondering out loud here as we talk about this, and I'd had an opportunity to see briefly from Mr. Humphrey a copy of this, but haven't really been able to talk to the other provider groups to think through the ramifications of this in terms of the marketplace, in terms of the administration of medication, any medication, therapy, any medication that could now be administered in a pharmacy by a provider who has great knowledge about medications but maybe not about a physical assessment of a patient. And so I'm just thinking about the ramifications of this as an amendment in a committee that hasn't really given consideration to what that means for healthcare overall for very sick people. And I know you are just testifying, Mr. Weiberg, about you've had some years to think about this, and so I'm wondering if you can elaborate on that for me at all. I mean, if you have had conversations with the Board of Medical Practice or the Board of Nursing or with physicians or nurses or others about this change in scope.
Dr. Weiber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, this is not a board bill. I think you might have to get Mr. Humphrey up here. My understanding, because I asked that same question of him, my understanding is that he has reached out to those groups and they don't object, but this is not a Board of Pharmacy initiative.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Weiberg, I know it's not a Board of Pharmacy initiative, but while you were here, I thought I'd ask your perspective on that. Mr. Chair, if Mr. Humphrey has anything to add.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Buck Humphrey. I represent both the Pharmacy Advocacy Task Force, which the previous testifier, Ms. Root, told you about, the collection of the college, our system pharmacists, and MPHA. Representative Peterson, yes, we had the distinct pleasure of working with and meeting with the Minnesota Nurses Association, the Minnesota Nurse Practitioners, and really had a good collegial meeting about these practices and how we can all be part of the solution. As you all know, in team-based care, our pharmacists, like Ms. Root, are managing teams of pharmacists within a hospital system under protocols by those systems. The board, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, Dr. Weiberg, but the board will obviously have very specific guidance protocols if there are questions. But I would say to you and to your question, my understanding is that there's no opposition to this bill, that this is a very good idea supported and also supported by the APRNs. The MMA does not oppose this bill.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Humphrey, I appreciate you testifying. It is, to me, without hearing in the policy committee, a significant change in scope, and so I'm going to reach out and, you know, just think this through on my own, talk with the providers. But we were talking in committee last night on another topic about how healthcare is delivered and different providers have different parts of that responsibility, and it is in part a check and a balance. And when we concentrate all the things in the hands of one, so in this case, the ability to fill a prescription, dispense it, and administer it all in one place without the check and balance of other providers. And I understand team-based care for sure. But when you think about Minute Clinics, you think about the expansion of CVS, CVS entering the market and acquiring insurance companies, and what that does in terms of disrupting the marketplace and in terms of care delivery, this seems really open-ended to me. So I'm glad that you're here so we can talk about it on the record. And I'm just going to do a little more digging, and we'll stay in touch with you. But it seems like a pretty significant change coming to us as an amendment, and I just want to put that onto the record for you and for Representative Baker.
Thank you, Representative Murphy. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. And Representative Murphy really touched on a lot of the same concerns that I have. When we do, this seems to me to be a huge change in scope of practice. And there's another bill moving, of course, that Mr. Humphrey is lobbying that has to do with allowing pharmacists to prescribe. And now here's one allowing pharmacists basically under their changing the definition of practice of pharmacy to allow pharmacists to administer any medication, as I read. This is very broad. It's not limited to Vivitrol, which it certainly could be, but this is just a big change in scope of practice. And as I understood, maybe Chair Schumacher could comment, because all the other scope of practice bills this session have come with a great deal of preliminary work and carefully considered in his committee, and everybody had to jump through all the same hoops, and our statutes actually require some of that process. So I was quite surprised to see this in this amendment. It just, the amendment by deleting just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 words makes a what I think is a pretty big change. And it may be that it's fine change, I don't know, but I don't know why we would do this as an amendment at the last second like this in the Finance Committee instead of having a real hearing on it. And I don't know if there are people in the room here that, you know, it's fine to say, oh, well, nobody's opposed, but I don't know if people were noticed to be here if they would be opposed or not. So that's my first comment, kind of just in line with what Representative Murphy was talking about. I also have some questions about the second piece, the what was the base bill and was also amended here. I don't know, Mr. Chair, I don't know if anybody wants to comment on my first part before I move to the second part of my concerns here.
I don't know if anybody from the audience wants to comment on that or testify. They can. They have not come down for the portion of the bill that we requested that. But it's a fair point, Representative Liebling, and the bill is being laid over. It is not being moved on to another committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so my second concern, or just question, I guess, is about the underlying issue. And I guess this would be a question for Representative Baker. So there's on lines 3.21, 3.22, it talks about, well, that whole Part B here talks about information necessary, that there has to be some information necessary to evaluate the effectiveness of the grant program. And so as I'm thinking about this, and some of the testimony that we heard about different ways to do this. I mean, we all, let's just say, we all want to accomplish the goal. No question about that. But when we're thinking about appropriating $1 million, and even though this isn't called a pilot program here, but I'm sort of understanding this with the evaluation to be somewhat of a pilot program, and I'm wondering since you're saying in here, shall provide information necessary to evaluate the effectiveness, what kind of outcome would you, how would you measure the effectiveness? How do you think about being able to tell if providing this pretty expensive product to help with this problem is better than doing it some of the other ways that we have? What are you going to be looking at? Is it going to be deaths? Is it going to be how often people use it? Or, you know, just how are we going to see whether this $1 million was well spent?
Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair and members, I think that's a great question, Representative Liebling. My outcome on this thing has been, I know we've thought of the idea of the deactivation pouches before, never had been able to find the resources to do this. Should this bill get passed and sent into law, it would provide between 300 to 400,000 packets that was passed around the room in areas of the state that are maybe struggling more than others to find ways of getting this to the garbage safely or out of the hands or out of the medicine cabinets. A specific report, I'm not sure what that would look like quite yet. And actually just yesterday was the mail-in component that was brought to me by the PCA. I had not heard of that mail-in component until yesterday. I'm very open to looking at other less expensive manners or more impacting messages. I am not here to support a certain kind of disposal. I want them out of the medicine cabinets, and however that looks, I'm willing to work with anyone and everyone. So saying that, we can tighten this up. As the chair has said, we are laying this over for getting the bill better. And I think more ideas are floating along in a very short session. I am committed to meeting with you and maybe Representative Murphy as well to talk about what are the rules that we can live by to make sure that my intention, again, for the pharmacies to do some more injecting later on is to make sure we skip the step that's been an ongoing prescription that's been called for that requires less work to get to the provider to get that shot of Vivitrol, quite honestly. But if we can make sure that we can expand the teams of providers and the teams of pharmacists to help this issue and other issues with mental health, I think we have a real win-win here. So I'm going to do some more work on this with Representative Liebling, and I'll find a better answer. But this is still coming to me with some new ideas, new technologies. In fact, next week, my friends from the company Viterra here in Minnesota who testified, we're going to be in Atlanta speaking to the National Opioid Summit down there next week and talking about the work that we're doing in Minnesota, talking about the legislation that we're trying to work through. And we're going to find some probably new ideas next week. I may come to you next week or after a break and kind of come to you with some great new ideas. So this is a very ongoing, moving fluid situation, and I'm committed to making this better.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you. So thank you, Representative Baker. I wonder if, this is the kind of thing where when you want to sort of have some sort of evaluation of a program, usually the way to do that is to work on that from the beginning, to set up if you're going to have some sort of an experiment here, just so that you know that we're going to put this out there and then we're going to evaluate it at the end. You got to really line that up at the beginning. And I wonder if you've talked with the Department of Health about how to do that effectively, because, you know, it may be that you need to do this within a certain geographic area or to certain kinds of people, and that there needs to be some data collection on the back end. I mean, there's just more to it than just doing it and then saying give the information necessary, because nobody's going to know what that is, or it might not be collected in the right way to be useful. So, and I certainly don't oppose the idea, but I just want to, if we're going to spend money and we're going to try to evaluate stuff, I just want to make sure that what we get back is useful to go forward, so we're not just really wasting our money and not knowing what we're getting.
Mr. Chair. Representative? Great point. I think my discussions have been more focused towards the pharmacy, the dispensing units and dispensing places that I have asked them, if these were provided for you to hand out when an opioid prescription is being dispensed, do you have any problem doing this? Every one of them has said they have no problem at all. My hope, I guess, and my expectations would have been the pharmacist would take 15 seconds to tell them how important this is to use this pouch when you're done using those pills. We don't have a formalized system yet. My drive has been to make sure that the moment of dispensing, our providers there, like I hope the doctors and providers are doing in the exam room, are telling them how important pharmaceutical heroin should not be sitting in your medicine cabinet. So I'm hoping with a tool to use or other ideas to make sure that we find a process to get them out of those cabinets. So I'm relying on the industry to do this, to help us get back our communities from this epidemic. So we'll work on that as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I raised my hand because I was really concerned about Section 1 that was added in the DE. And I really believe that we owe it to the public and to all the industry and the patients that are served by them to actually do things with public notice. This bill was noticed as a prescription drug deactivation and disposal product distribution and grant program. No one who is interested in the scope of pharmacy services, in licensing issues about how do we design our healthcare system, what's the vision for the future, would ever from that title think that they need to pay attention to this bill. We have not heard from anyone. We've heard from people who are involved in the industry that they've talked to people, but we haven't heard from them on what the impacts are. And I'm very uncomfortable about this potentially being folded into a finance bill where nobody looks at, hardly we do. We get a big, thick finance bill. Nobody in the general healthcare community is going to wade through whether it's 100 or 300 pages what's in there to find something like this. And I'm very uncomfortable with the process. It reminds me of way back when assisted living, housing with services, was brought to the legislature as a problem in rural areas where hotels in town had farmers, and when the wife died or when they stopped farming, the kids moved to the old hotel in downtown. And the kids would say, can the person at the front desk just remind Dad at 10 and at 2 to take his pills because he's not really good about remembering that? And there was liability concerns by the owner of those kind of places. And so we created housing with services, never imagining that that would become assisted living, which has created some really wonderful options for our seniors, but it has grown into an industry that is not regulated in any way, that was never created with consumer protections, and now we're taking the brunt of the public's outrage after the Star Tribune revealed some of the gaps because we didn't think through what that meant in terms of creating a whole new service system. As I look at this and go, what's the worst thing that could happen? I'm not sure. You know, it could turn every neighborhood drugstore into a methadone clinic. Maybe that would be good. Maybe that would be healthcare and be more accessible to the people who need it. But I just think it has implications that need policy consideration, and I am very, very uncomfortable about this staying within our purview, and would ask the author to consider seriously deleting Section 1 because we have not noticed the public, we have not taken testimony on it from the broader healthcare industry, and I have not heard anything about this until this amendment showed up before us.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Seeing no other member questions, Representative Baker, I just had two things. I had a bill that we put together regarding the disposal bags. It wasn't ready for prime time. I didn't even know what they looked like at the time. Since gotten a lot of information about that. Two issues. Number one, the disposal bags, we've got a local Minnesota company here that does that. This is not proprietary to that company, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, members, that is correct. We actually removed a couple of the words in the amendment to make sure that it wasn't specific to their trademark, if you will. But yeah,
that's what we meet with lots of companies that correct. Do this. So that would be number one. Number two, did you take this to the Environment Committee or anywhere to talk about the disposal of this or contamination of the water?
Mr. Chair, it has not come and was not pointed in that direction. It was just referred to this committee, so I don't know. It has not gone in that direction.
All right. Yeah, I just, just since that time, I had a kidney stone. I went and to the pharmacist as I talked to you about and came back, and it actually had one of those little disposal bags with it so I could get rid of it, which I thought was cool. It's actually a lot smaller than the one that we passed around. It was only about that big. But I think it's pretty cool that we're dealing with this to pull that out of the system. And those things are dangerous in your medicine cabinet, and that's a real present danger. If we balance that with the danger of something that may happen in the land down the road somewhere else, and balance that with me having to mail it somewhere or drive it somewhere, I'm not going to do that. I'm a busy person. I'm just not going to. I'm very unlikely to do that. So I think that's the way to go. It's a better policy. So just my personal opinion on that. But so I hope that doesn't get derailed by that. And if there is evidence that there is contamination of some kind or another, that we have that to balance that policy to balance before we make a decision moving forward. So with that, thank you for bringing the bill forward.
Thank you.
So 3643 as amended is laid over. Thanks, Representative Baker.
Thank you, members and Mr. Chair.
Next up, we have House File 3195. Representative Albright moves House File 3195 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. There are no amendments. Representative Albright to House File 3195.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill would require the Council to study using telehealth technologies like high-fidelity simulation and teleconferencing in order to complete portions of the clinical experiences required in college counseling programs, increasing access to telehealth technologies for use in supervision of persons, completing post-degree practice work experiences, training for licensure, increasing client access. Study will consider a number of parameters in the technological area. Work group will have representatives of the Board of Psychology, Social Work, Marriage and Family Therapy, and Behavioral Health and Therapy. Colleges that have accredited social work, psychology, alcohol and drug counseling, marriage and family therapy, and professional counseling programs and professional counseling associations. Amen.
All right. No testifiers?
None.
All right, so anyone in the audience want to testify on this bill? Seeing none, member questions? Seeing none, final word?
I have none.
With that, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 3195 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. No, 3195 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. House File 4193. Representative Albright moves House File 4193 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. House File 4193 is before us. Representative, to your bill.
Mr. Chair, this bill implements the Board of Optometry fee increase for annual licensure renewal and adds fees for jurisprudence, state examination, optometric education, continuing education, data bank registration, and data requests and labels. I have a testifier who can give a brief explanation of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Randy Snyder, Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Optometry. House File 4193 is a technical cleanup bill that happened as an oversight of the last day of session in 2017. There'll be an identical one coming up with the Board of Social Work in a second. The policy aspect of the budget bill was approved by this committee, and we are stellar in our testimony, so it made out of this House committee testifying in 2017. Expense was approved. The fees were not. It was just merely an oversight, and so they were unintentionally omitted in the final hours of the 2017 session. The board can't proceed without out these fees. We're a very small board. $173,000 a year is all our annual budget is. There's no known opposition to this bill, and this would allow the board to re-engage with stakeholders to proceed with those policy implementation. And as we testified in 2017, I'll leave this very brief in respect of your time, minimize this testimony, and stand for questions. I do thank House Committee staff for their stellar work in bringing us here today. Thank you.
All right, Representative Considine.
No, not this one.
All right. Other questions? Seeing no other questions, does anyone want to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Albright renews his motion that 4193 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. 4193 is referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Next up, we have House File 4192. Representative Albright moves House File 4192 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Representative Albright, the bill is before us.
Mr. Chair and members, this, just like 4193, is an opportunity to correct the technical oversight from the fiscal 18-19 biennial budget proposal, which occurred at the very end of the regular session. I have two testifiers who can explain in similar fashion to the optometric bill the correction that is needful in order for them to proceed.
All right, Representative Albright, I understand that this was passed. It was, we voted for it, it passed, and it was just, there was just a technical problem where it was not included in the final spreadsheet versus language. Is that correct?
Couldn't have said it any better myself.
All right. Questions? Representative Considine.
You're taxing social workers, Representative Albright.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Considine.
No, yeah, no, you're not. It was a facetious question.
He withdraws his question.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Is there anyone from the audience who'd like to testify on House File 4192?
Welcome to the committee.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Megan Arneson. I'm a licensed graduate social worker in the state of Minnesota. It was brought to my attention just earlier this week that this bill was being presented, and I was just pretty surprised. Representative Considine, I appreciate your quip there. As a social worker who's paid several dues and fees on top of my education in both a bachelor's degree in social work and master's degree in social work, it is quite the fee to renew and maintain my license over the course of the years. I've discussed this with my colleagues, and it's just been something that's been on my mind, and feel like the increase in fees is a financial hardship that I've decided to make the sacrifice on because of the professional reputation that a license does provide for social workers. And just wanted to have my voice heard that this increase in fees just prevents them from moving forward with their license, and is something that I need to reassess every time it comes up for renewal.
Thank you, Ms. Arneson, and we do appreciate that, and this committee does have to approve increases in fees for licensure for lots of people who need licenses, and so we don't often hear from the practitioners, and many times people think, well, it's just a small amount, or it's just part of doing business, but we do realize that it is a sacrifice and an ongoing cost. So appreciate you taking the time to come here. Also appreciate you taking care of patients in Minnesota. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my wife is a social worker, but this one actually passed already, and we're just correcting it. The time to object is before it's passed, so it's actually really too late this time.
Not technically. I believe
No.
thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just thank you to the testifier for coming down and making the effort. And I just wanted to note that there is another letter of opposition in our packet, and I don't know if this, the testifier is, it doesn't actually have a name on it. It's sincerely members of the St. Catherine University, University of St. Thomas School of Social Work. So I don't know, you know, no one's individual name is on it, but I did just want to say that apparently the testifier is not the only person who has some concerns.
All right. Appreciate that. Further member discussion? All right. Seeing none, Representative Albright renews his motion that House File 4192 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, no. 4192 is re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All right. Are we done? Oh, okay, that's your last one. I thought you had one more. All right, thanks, members. We're going to be going late on Tuesday and Wednesday after break. Appreciate everybody being here last night, and appreciate everybody sticking around for all of the testimony last night. I know it was a long day after a lot of other long days, and appreciate the respectful debate then. And we'll see everybody after Easter Passover break. Hope everybody enjoys.